The United Nations General Assembly convenes here in New York just as a set of disturbing developments has emerged in the Middle East. Will these reverse some of the hopeful trends we've seen in the region over the past 2 years? The fall of dictatorships, the rise of pro-democracy movements, the theoretical decline in the isolation of Israel as potential democratic allies inch closer to finding the means to achieve peace and build ties of economic cooperation and prosperity. I said potential. What has happened in the past few weeks underscores that Islamist movements and small-scale militias are still capable of undermining any sort of coherent leadership in the region. The deterioration of the situation in Syria has only increased Israel's sense of isolation. Israel's leaders seem to be aggressively trying to undermine President Obama in the U.S. presidential campaign. Finally, the anti-blasphemy demonstrations over that Innocence of Muslims video produced in the United States have suggested the bitterness toward the West is undiminished in many quarters. Jeremy Bowen is Middle East editor for the BBC. His latest book is out in late October called The Arab Uprisings, published by Simon & Schuster. Jeremy Bowen, welcome to the program.
Very nice to be here.
A lot to take on. What do you think the headline is as the General Assembly convenes? What will they take up or likely ignore?
Well, one of the big headlines, I think, this week is why can't the world body, the United Nations, really get to grips with huge problems like Syria? What we've been seeing really in some ways is the impotence of the United Nations. Now, of course, there's a distinction between the General Assembly, who often pass a lot of things and nothing happens, and the Security Council, who have a somewhat different agenda. And the UN is, of course, only ever as strong as the sum of the will of its members. But it's sad, I think, after, you know, relative optimism in recent years at times about what the UN can do, to see it going back to almost like the time of the Cold War, you know, when it got paralyzed.
You know, it does seem, and the CIA developments, the setbacks for the CIA in Libya suggests that that conflict is sort of the end of the line for this round of interventions on the part of the West. We may see something in Syria, but Libya seems to have marked the end.
Well, I think it's interesting being actually on this side of the Atlantic and seeing the differences, the way it's perceived, the way that that attack, the four dead in Benghazi last week, just how that's seen in the context of the wider Middle East. Now, it seems to me that that's a very sharp reminder to Americans that is it worth meddling in these places? Is it worth getting involved? Is it worth intervening? You know, I heard stuff coming out of America saying, wait a minute, we helped them get their freedom. And this is what we're getting in return. Now, of course, since then, there have been big demonstrations in support of that poor dead ambassador and his colleagues in Benghazi in Libya. But actually, if you're in Libya, as I was last week, I went over there when all this happened, there's a different perception. They don't think that the West or the United States gave them their freedom. They think they took their own freedom, and their freedom is something they want to do with as they like. And I think right across the region, what you see now is the people were always mistaken if they thought that the fall of the Arab dictators, or at least some of them, would turn these places overnight into Sweden or Denmark or, you know, or the Netherlands, some kind of nice democratic countries where everybody can get along and try and make compromises. Far from it. What it actually also shows is that the leaders now, democratically elected in some cases, including in Libya, have to take some cognizance of public opinion. And in Egypt, public opinion is anti-Israel. It's anti-United States. It's anti-Western. Whenever I go out in the streets with a TV camera these days in Egypt, I normally get threatened with violence if there's any kind of disturbance going on, sometimes with death. You know, you didn't get that a couple of years ago.
And it's smug, then, of Western nations to believe in any sense that they did any of these nations a favor. In fact, we would want them to believe that they took their own freedom, because ultimately the basis of their stability is their own self-image, self-sense of having done this on their own.
Well, we in the West have a bit of a credibility problem in the Middle East, in the Arab Middle East, and that is because for many, many years we sustained the dictators. They were very useful friends to us. Mubarak in Egypt was a necessary man. He was the most important man in the Arab world for the Americans.
We're speaking with the Middle East editor for the BBC, Jeremy Bowen, who's here in New York for the United Nations General Assembly, which convenes this week. I'm wondering if you observe the situation in the U.S. presidential campaign as anything different than you've seen, you know, over the last 20 years. You've got the leader of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, attempting in a very aggressive way to, it seems, intervene in the election or at least express a strong preference for Mitt Romney over Barack Obama. Is this new or is this, I mean, it seems to me a little bit more aggressive than what I've seen.
Yeah, I think Prime Minister Netanyahu plays politics here in the United States in a way that no other Israeli leader ever has. That's, of course, because he spent part of his childhood here. He sounds like an American. He believes he understands intimately the way things work here, and he believes he can leverage something out of it, and I think that he does. You know, if you look at his last few speeches to joint sessions of the Congress, I mean, he gets both sides were competing to see how many standing ovations they could give the guy. And I think that gives him a feeling of influence and power. And, you know, of course, it's a difficult thing because if he plays politics against Obama and Obama wins, then post the election, it might not be very easy for him at all. I mean, they already have a terrible relationship by all accounts. And so as a result of that, maybe it can't get all that much worse. I mean, Netanyahu tried to do something a little bit similar in the Clinton years. But I think it's really become accentuated recently. And it's also, of course, very accentuated because of Netanyahu's views about what should happen with Iran.
And the irony in Iran is the Iranians actually did have an impact on a presidential campaign back in 1980. The hostage crisis was one of the things that did in Jimmy Carter. What do you think of the situation in Iran? Do you think the proliferation of nukes is something that the U.S. should draw a red line, should express a clear trigger to go to war over?
I don't think any country should say, unless it's a really, really important existential thing for that country, say, offer an ultimatum. You know, Britain in 1939 gave Germany an ultimatum about Poland and said, unless you withdraw your troops, we're at war. And Germany didn't, and we were at war. Now, no one's suggesting that quite that happens with the United States and with Iran at the moment. But the fact is that the Israelis see where the red line is in a different place to where the Americans see a red line, where the red line should be. The Israelis say that the capability to think about building a weapon and being capable of perhaps building a weapon is the red line. The Americans say, look, if they are going to get a weapon and they're about to put it on a missile and use it, then we'll do something about it. And of course, America's got a lot more military power and maybe could do something then. I think that for Mr. Netanyahu, the prime minister, this is a really, really big issue. But actually, and he clearly wants to have an attack on Iran, and they talk about doing it themselves, though that might just be bluster. If you go to Israel, as I do quite a bit, there's a much more nuanced range of opinion over there. People are aware of the dangers and difficulties of going it alone, including people who are in the intelligence community there and in the military.
Why has the Arab Spring increased Israel's isolation and not reduced it?
Well, because the ground is shifting under them. I think Israel liked stability. They liked having a top Israeli analyst said to me a few years ago, you know, in the Israeli foreign ministry in Jerusalem, the first thing they do every morning is say a prayer for President Mubarak's health, because he's vital to them. He was vital to them. He'd keep the Palestinians in line. He'd keep them along the paths that suited Israel. He was a full partner in the blockade of Gaza, keeping shut the Egyptian side of the border.
That's so sad in the sense that Israel constantly speaks of itself as the one democracy in the Middle East, and here it prays for these dictators and needs them. And when confronted with electoral turmoil around its borders, its inclination is to shrink.
Yeah, batten down the hatches, build the walls a little bit higher.
Make it more a militaristic country.
Yeah, and of course, you think about Western countries. We're mainly democracies of different kinds, and it suited us to have one address to go to in countries. And that's the thing. It's much more confusing. People don't know who to ring.
Let's talk a little bit about this situation with the anti-blasphemy demonstrations around the world because of this film, Innocence of Muslims. So we've had conversations on this program, which are interesting to me, where people say, you don't understand America. You have anti-blasphemy laws or hate crime laws in the United States if certain things are said about Jews or African Americans. How come you don't have such laws against offense for Muslim iconography, Muslim symbols, that sort of thing? I'm wondering if it's possible for the United Nations to create an initiative that would talk about some sort of global convention on blasphemy, that would create a cooperative enterprise to control these kinds of incidents, not to interfere in anybody's free speech rights, but to basically recognize that there is a global interest in keeping people from going off the rails over a perceived sense of slight by enforcing a convention of human rights. Only in this particular case, it would be anti-blasphemy.
Be a great idea if they could make it work. But of course, you know, you think that the United Nations struggled for ages, and I don't think it's yet succeeded in coming up with a definition of terrorism. So in the end, how do you define blasphemy? I think that what we're seeing is, and you know, in Europe, where I come from, it's a pretty secular place in the main, and people don't quite understand the power religion has to shape lives and how people define themselves by religion. I think maybe it's understood a little bit better over here. But as a result of that, there's always a slightly incredulous reaction to the sorts of passions that blasphemy can ignite. But over large parts of the world where I live in, it's a day-to-day thing, and people are, as we've been seeing in the last week or so, they're extremely touchy about it. So, yeah, so it'd be great to have a convention about it. But, you know, you've got to get all those guys agreeing first. I think that'd be rather difficult.
In the internet age, is it easier to make a case for somebody being deliberately provocative as opposed to somebody just doing art?
Depends who you're talking to, you know. I'm sure the people listening to this program will be well aware of the differences and all of that. But in some of the streets I've been on in the Middle East in the last couple of weeks, very angry crowds, a lot of them with different sorts of agendas. But if you try to argue those subtleties and nuances, you wouldn't get very far, I'm afraid.
And certainly the human rights headline as the United Nations General Assembly convenes this week here in New York is, of course, the humanitarian disaster in Syria. No sense that that's going to improve anytime soon. Editor for our partner, the BBC in the Middle East, Jeremy Bowen, thanks so much.